All right, mentoring worship artists. Let me preface all this by saying this. I'm a musician by training, and so often, and I don't know exactly what all of you do, but I would guess that if you're involved in worship, there's also two seats over here if you want to bring them somewhere. Whatever capacity you're in, most likely there's some kind of primary area that you're involved in, right? You play guitar, praise team, you direct a choir, you choose worship songs, you know, those kinds of things. If you're like me, I've been a professional worship musician guy for 15 years. And you get pretty good at doing what you do in terms of, you know, you learn what resources there are. You get better at the guts of what you do. But if you're like me, if you were to stop at the end of the day or at the end of the week, you would stop and you would, if you were to assess what ministry have you done in that week, then it becomes maybe a little bit more difficult question. Now, and maybe this is different. Maybe I'm just a really bad Christian and bad minister, and you guys don't have this issue, but I'm going to guess that you do. That there's this, that we get the job done, we do our stuff, but then we have to stop and assess, you know, what is the guts of what we're doing? Like, what is the work that we are doing for the Christian church? How am I building the kingdom with moving notes around on a page or choosing hymns and those kinds of things? Now, I do not at all downgrade the applied area that we work in. You know, I am a firm believer if you're a pianist, you should practice your scales. If you are a composer, you should practice your voice leading. I affirm all those kinds of things. But I think that sometimes we just kind of have to stop, we have to back up and assess what is it we're really doing. So that's kind of the preface of this whole idea of mentoring musicians. I have grown quite fond of this idea of mentoring as really the primary way of doing ministry. And I'm gonna take you through some of that. I'll start off by telling you some of my my background, my story. I am 42, and like many people in my age and probably in down from my age, there's this common lament, generational lament, of not. All right, let's see what we can do here. Is there one more? Okay, good. There's one more. Perfect.
I got this too.
Okay. And you know, if you want a lounge, that's good too. So there's this frequent lament from people of my generation and down of not having role models. You talk to sociologists, what they'll say is partly breakdown of family, partly just the way modern life goes. There are not these traditional avenues. So if you think about traditional or indigenous societies, you think about the kinds of things that go on. Extended family, often grandparents living in the same house, often some kind of rite of passage. If you think about bar mitzvahs and things like that. And what ends up happening in a lot of modern cultures, you don't have any of that stuff. There is no... there's no point where you, unless you're, in Boy Scouts and you're going into different badges and that kind of thing, there's no sense of, okay, I am now at this level of human being. I was well into my 20s before I could refer myself as a man rather than just a guy. Like, there's just no clear threshold of manhood, womanhood, all of these kinds of things. There's a basic breakdown of those things. And so, what you find, and it's getting worse with kind of extended family breakdown and more mobility of families. So you're moving away from your extended family. So what you find just in society in general is that people are looking for role models. And this is the problem with life, is that you don't know exactly how to do it, because you've never been that age before. and there's always some milestone that's coming up, whether it's puberty or marriage or first child or dealing with aging parents, wherever it is, there is always something on the horizon that you don't know about that you need someone older than you to help you figure that out. So, and I'm in that same boat, just kind of having a sense of, just trying to make it up. And, you can go to school to learn how to be a composer, but there's no school to teach you how to be a man or be married or anything like that. So that's your larger societal context. Now, in that, and part of this is reflecting, I'll tell you two parts of the story. The first part is just thinking about, in my own life, so I'll tell you about a couple people that spoke into my life early on. One was Mr. C. Mr. Schifelli is a band director, and he was great. He was this guy. He always had his bags under his eyes because he was always staying up late composing jazz tunes. And I was really into jazz when I was in high school, and so it was really fun. He had a fresh new arrangement, and it would always have a coffee stain on it. It was like his seal. But he was great, and he would, tell us stories about, when he was a teenager and he got to play with Pete Gallagher, all this kind of stuff like that. It was always these great stories, and he would take time to, teach you things. And, at the time, for a number of years, I didn't think about this at all. But then I realized later that he saw something in me as a musician that he wanted to foster. And I am sure that he didn't say, oh, I'd like to mentor Gray and make sure that he knows, the right path. But, I'd come in and I'd say, all right, this C chord thing. I've got the C and the E. What's the third note? It's just three notes, right? And he would show me, okay, yeah, you do it this way. And then I'd practice it, and, he would give me unlimited hall passes to come and to work out my stuff. I also remember one time it was really funny. A couple of the better players in jazz band, he brought us to a Kiwanis Club fashion show. It was my first professional gig. I got $10 and a Coke to go to this local hotel or whatever and play the thing. We just we played our jazz. It was a big deal because we got out of school for the afternoon. So looking back, I'm even kind of laughing about the bags under the eyes and the coffee stains. Because it, I don't know if that was there, if there's this direct influence, but there's clearly this pattern between him and me. I'm always, at the 11th hour finishing up a piece and bringing it into my choir and whatever, So that's one person that really spoke in my life. Another one, a guy named Ron. Now, this is kind of interesting. This is the first time that I had ever heard the word mentoring. It's not something that you banter about a whole lot. Well, at least I didn't in my day. I think there were books about it and stuff. Now, but this guy, Ron, I have to tell you this part of it. Okay, you probably can't imagine this, but when I was in college, I started growing my hair out long. I really wanted to have dreadlocks, but it just wouldn't work because my hair is just too fine. So I just walk around with really greasy hair for a week and then just give it up. But I had real long hair, and I was kind of in my punk and new age phase. And I started going to this Baptist church, and I don't know if any of you are Baptist, but I think it's probably changed a little bit. But at that time, Christians didn't have long hair. Okay. And so it was really funny because this guy, I think he saw me as kind of the ultimate trophy, right? If he could win me over, he could put me on his resume, right? And so he actually offered it one, but this is the first time I heard the word mentoring. So he offered to mentor me, and I'm like, what does that mean? And he explained, and how he explained it, I thought was a really compelling definition of mentoring. He said, you spend time with someone in order to gain their vision of God. And I said, that's really great. And it turns out that I decided that I didn't want to spend time with this person to gain a vision of God. I mean, it wasn't a good fit. But that definition kind of stuck with me, this idea that, you're imparting a particular vision. And that's something that I kind of chewed on, I kind of came back to over the years, to think about, because we usually think about education as this very specific and active thing. You know, you go to this class, and you know, and I give you some bit of knowledge or wisdom or whatever, and then you go out and you, I don't know exactly what you do about it. I think that's probably part of the problem with education, that you don't know exactly, you know, what's the next step. And it's something I will get to a little bit later, but something that keeps people that do workshops like this humble is realizing that, you know, you're probably not going to remember most of what I said today. Oh, I hate to say that. Please remember one thing. And not that thing that I just did.
but not that.
So it really struck me that there's a fancy word for it, which is enculturation. Okay, the things that you know, but you don't know how you know. You know, you didn't go to school for them. You just know. You know, so why don't Baptists drink? I don't know. I mean, it's not like there's a rule about it. It's just, you know, it's just, you don't do that. It's just not the right thing. And you just know, you know. And so mentoring is kind of like this intentional enculturation, as it were. So I kept that in my mind, you know, after my punk phase. Not that punks can't be Christians, but I kind of went through a time of, you know, being outside of the church, and eventually came back during grad school, and they got married. And at one point, if you guys have been to, well, probably not the ones that were under 20 or 14 or whatever, but the marriage seminar. You ever been to one of these things? I can't remember the name of this seminar. It was one of the. It's the exact kind of thing that I hate. Like they give you the form. It's, first of all, the people that lead it are, it's like super smiley and just, you know, they're oh, how about the toilet seat, you know, yeah, issue, you know, and really. And so then they give you this big brochure, and they, you know, give you the three things, and you have to fill out the three things, and then you get the action points and all that kind of stuff. Well, even though that's totally not my style, I got done with the weekend, and I filled out all my action points for each thing, and the takeaway points, and put them into the back page, and then at the end you have this back page of your takeaway points for the marriage seminar. And one of the things I realized that kind of kept coming back up is that, and this is a point that they made in the marriage seminar, was, you know, 4 years to get a degree in your field, 6 months to a year to learn how to drive, you know, but you just go to a judge and get a marriage license, you know, and it really kind of struck me like, this is, you know, this is hard work, and how do you learn how to do this, you know? Maybe we could read a book, you know. I'll be a better husband. So one of my action points for that, see, because I'm a you know, team player. I even though I don't like that style of learning, I said, no, I'm gonna work on my action points. So I decided that I wanted to find a mentor. You know, and once again, some of this stuff started coming back. This idea of mentoring, or someone older who kind of teaches you to do something, and so. I found a guy in my church who I really respected, and I asked him to mentor me. And it was funny. When he answered the phone, you know, I didn't know if he knew anything about mentoring or if this would be on his radar. But it was just like he had been sitting at the phone waiting, and he was like, "I would be honored." And that was the start of it. And we started just meeting, and it was just great. Like I said, I respected him, and I would, you know, he just kind of gave me free rein to ask him questions. If we wanted to do Bible studies, if we wanted to do, you know, just talking, it was mainly just kind of talking. You know, just, well, what do you do when X, Y, Z? You know, and so that was the first time I started thinking about it. I'm going to tell you the second part of my story in a minute, but what I want you to do right now is this: I want you to take a minute. We will. It's 17 of 3, we are going to reconvene at 3:15, and I want you to write in 3 action points. No. I want you to just write down, and somewhere will you remember it. I want you to think for a couple minutes about people who have maybe mentored you formally or informally, people that have spoken into your life, whether it's a family member, a teacher, a sibling, anything like that. Just anybody that has kind of served those kinds of roles that I'm talking about. good. What I would like you to do is this. Yeah, you don't have to share those or anything like that. You can keep them to yourself. But I would like you to, if you would consider writing to them and thanking them, I think it would be a really good thing. It's a way of kind of honoring the way that people have spoken into your life. So that's your, you know, one of your action points for this class. So with all of that in mind, I will go to the second part of my story. And now the same church where I was being mentored by this guy named Dwight, and just thinking about, you know, a little bit about how does this work what's happening here and how is it supposed to work. So as I'm kind of just considering these things, the church that I was a part of in Pittsburgh, I was now on staff at the church that I was attending in grad school, and they had a really strong college program, and I was half secretary, half music director, so I got to meet all the students, and I was kind of like the entry point for the church, and so, you know, is this person here, is that person there, and that kind of thing. And so I got to know a lot of the students really well. And there was a guy named Kirk, who was a drummer, and just a real likable guy, and we would, we would talk, and, you know, he was a favorite drummer, and he was really the Neil Peart and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we just talked geeky music stuff and had fun doing that. So then at one point he comes to me and he says, the leader of the fellowship has asked me to be the worship director next year, you know. And I said, well, that's great. He said, why told him no? What are you doing? Why'd you tell him no? And he says, well, because I don't know anything about it. I'm a drummer. You know, I'm not a worship leader. I don't know. The first thing I said, Kirk, tell him yes, and I will lead you through this whole thing, you know. And so he did say yes. And then the unfortunate thing was that right at that very time, I got a new job in a different town. A little bait and switch going on there. I actually felt horrible about it, you know, because I really, and I was totally intent. I just saw this is the way that God is kind of helping me make this transition from being a mentoree to being a mentor. Is, you know, this guy coming to me out of the blue and saying, you know, I'll only do it if you help me do it, you know, and so it really and then the other thing about leaving that church was that I realized as I was leaving that it was a very me-centered ministry, you know. It was like as I now, of course, I was probably thinking a little bit too much of myself in retrospect. You know, God can, you know. The Church of Jesus Christ had survived a long time before me and will continue after me. But there were lots of things that I hadn't done. You know, I hadn't brought anybody under my wing in any kind of assistant capacity. Or, you know, people hadn't owned the vision. And so I left. And actually one of the things that happened at that particular church, we had been walking a tight wire of contemporary and traditional in a good way. You know, there was a tension between those two things that was very informative. And after I left, it kind of just balanced because of the people who came in, and because I hadn't really spoken about my vision for the ministry, it became a very, very different thing after that. And so I went to this new church, this church in Tallahassee, just really intent on not letting this happen again. You know, just right away. You have to start a job very quickly and, you know, get your resources all together and figure out who the people are. But right after I was had things running, I started to think very seriously about who can I impart this ministry to. And so I eventually approached two people in the choir about it. Lynn and Caroline. Lynn is a man, Caroline is a woman. They both had degrees in music and were just very interested, and you could tell that they were musicians who they liked what I was doing. They probably wouldn't have talked theology or anything like that, you know, or talked about it as theology, but you could tell that the wheels were spinning, you know, as they observed the choices that I would make in ministry, that they were, you know, kind of trying to figure out, why did he make that decision? What's behind that? How does a musician start applying musical skills to theology, to worship, you know? And so I approached him and I said, would you be interested in working with me on, you know, weekly, bi-weekly basis? And so we started having meetings. And it ended up being just a wonderful thing. They were both very capable people, you know, came in with real skills, and they both were eager to learn. And basically what I did is I would just, sometimes I'd give them assignments, like I would say, conduct the, I'm going to split the choir into two, you take the men, you take the women, I'll observe you, next week I'll observe you. We would talk about what went well and what went poorly in those times. I would explain the kind of decisions that I was making. You know, I said, on Sunday we're going to do two songs back to back. It's kind of a weird transition. Here's what I'm thinking about it. They also helped me think through from the point of view of the person in the pew. You know, how does that play out? You know, this kind of planning decision, how does that play out? Those kinds of things. So that was the kind of first formal mentoring thing that I had. It was a very positive experience. And they actually, I left that church after 2 years, and they became kind of a real support system for me, you know, as I kind of had to think about the direction the church was taking, the direction that I was taking, and they kind of helped me sort out some of those issues. In fact, when I interviewed, my next job was at Northwestern College in Iowa. And when I interviewed there, I had to sneak out and not tell anybody that I was interviewing. And so, Lynn drove me to the airport like after a choir rehearsal, and then I got back by the Sunday service. And so that was, you know, it was not only useful to them, but it was useful to me. And they're both in music ministry still. So then I was at Northwestern College, and then this became part of my job, essentially. You know, I was half in the music department teaching worship, and I was half in the chapel ministry, kind of overseeing chapel and other worship ministries. And so I was with students all the time. I had student apprentices who would help me out. And so there was this natural, you know, it was actually a really good situation in the sense that I would teach students something in the class, and then I would, I couldn't pull any punches with them because, you know, I would say, okay, this is what you're supposed to do. And they'd be like, you didn't do that last service, you know? And so there was this, you know, kind of, honest relationship between the students. But it was, and I would get to work with four students all year long each year as they would lead ensembles, and I would, you know, kind of help them through doing this stuff. So that was... I still, you know, even though I'm doing a workshop on mentoring, I don't think of myself as any particular expert on it. I just kind of speak from my experiences, and I probably have had a little bit more experience than some people in this area. So what I learned from those times are the following things. Get your pencils out, because this is going to be good. You don't even need to get your pencils out, because I wrote it right down on your thing. Yeah, under point four. All right, so things that I've learned about mentoring people, and I'm assuming that the mentoring is going on in a worship setting, that, you know, whatever art you do, that's what we're kind of talking about. It's in a context of a specific ministry, although I'm sure you could apply some of these things more broadly. So the first thing is give it away, in the words of, what's your name?
Pay it forward.
No. I'm thinking. What's the thing? No. Not the. Red Hot Chili. There you go. But I didn't actually name this section after the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And here's a basic idea: that God does not give you ministries to hoard for yourself. I mean, really, God doesn't give you anything to hoard for yourself, whether it's spiritual truth, ministry, positions. Of leadership, you know, this stuff is not given to you for your own, you know, personal power or sense of well-being or anything like that. You know, the reason that we work for the kingdom of God is because we love God, and as Marva Dawn said today, you know, we respond to God in joy with obedience. And so that's really what it's about. Now, this, you know, we're all going to agree with this, okay? But the reality is that it's very hard to live this way, because I know in my line of work the things that will endear me to my congregations. Usually, they're at complete cross purposes with what would be good for the congregation. So what would be, you know, good for me in terms of job security and all that kind of stuff is put myself out front, do stuff where people go, wow, we could never worship without that guy. What will we do if he ever left? Let's pay him more. See, that's you know, what you want in terms of a professional kind of thing. And this is what pastors deal with all the time, is that if a pastor were to say, you know, you're going to get very little from my sermons. You know, you're going to get little nuggets here and there. But really what, you know, my job is about is just kind of dissolving into all you people and letting you do ministry. You know, that's not very good. You know, professionally speaking, you want to say, like, look, if I'm not talking to you, you're going nowhere in your faith, all right? You know, so there's this real danger that in professional ministry or any kind of ministry of becoming the center of it. It's good for you. It's good, you know, people like to follow someone and kind of idolize someone, but ultimately it's destructive to both of you, right? It ultimately you hoard it for yourself. And this is what I realized when I was at the first church that I left before I could mention this drummer, was that I kept it all to myself, you know, and when I left, they were not changed from when I was there in the beginning, which is a bad thing, you know? I mean, yes, you can hire a succession of people, but hopefully the things that we do will have some kind of impact on the communities that we're in. So that's what I'm talking about here, is even though it puts you in a little bit more of a precarious situation in terms of your professional standing, your rate of pay, all of those kinds of things like that, an other-centered ministry is ultimately more effective. And I think really what God calls us to do is to give it away. Whenever you can, you know, God gives you something, the way to use that is not to use it for yourself, but to use it for someone else. You know, just kind of give it as fast as you can. But pay it forward is exactly the word that needs to be said there. Something else that I've learned. The crowd 12 and 3 principle. Think about Jesus' ministry. I like to think of Jesus as a good example of the Christian faith. Yes. As obvious as that may seem, we sometimes don't actually treat Jesus like an example for how we should do things. Just a rhetorical question. Do you think that Jesus would have had a megachurch? It's an interesting idea. I mean, you know, we can't dismiss it out of hand, but I think it's kind of when we think of a successful pastor, we think of someone who has a big church, right? Now, I just want to paint for you a broad and completely unspiritual vision of Jesus' ministry. So he's a rabbi, he's got some disciples. We know from the biblical accounts that the disciples were not just the 12 originally. There were, you know, a number of hangers-on who would follow. For instance, the thing that to me that is most poignant, you've got the Sermon on the Mount, feeding of 5,000. It's 5,000, right? I guess there's a 2,000 and 5,000, depending on which account you're talking. But yeah, you're talking a big group of people, about as big as you can get without a sound system. And so this is a guy who's at the height of his career, okay? And then he starts talking. You read the sequence here. Immediately from that, they're getting free food. This is a good thing. They like the guy. And then he starts talking about eating my body and drinking my blood. Not such a good sell. All right? And what does the account say after that? This is a hard saying, and many of the disciples left him, is what it said. And so now if you look at the trajectory, once again, from a completely unspiritual perspective, so Jesus goes from 5,000... lots of people leave him. He slowly gets down to 12. He's betrayed. The 12 desert him. And then he's hung on a cross. All right, this is not, the, you know, like Joel Osteen is not going to preach this particular method of church life. And I say it in a joking way, but it's you know, we I think, underestimate, you know, that when we talk about the way of the cross, this is not, you know, a health and wealth success kind of model of ministry, you know. And what you see, which is now the spiritual perspective of it, Jesus is slowly, through the parables, through the hard teachings, is slowly whittling down, who remains. And even though at the very end everybody deserts him, he entrusts the church, the future of the church, entrusts it to these people who betray him and who disown him and desert it. I mean, it's really a phenomenal thing. And then you look at the Christian church today, millions and millions of billions of people throughout history and throughout the world belong to the Church of Jesus Christ, which was, entrusted to these kind of neighborhoods pretty much. So what I want to do is look at this model of ministry as a way of looking at our own ministries. And this is not original. I can't remember the guy's name. I think it's F.F. Bruce. The Training of the Twelve is the name of the book. This idea. And basically what it says is this. What we understand of Jesus is what we read in the Bible. So we have all of these, we have parables, we have Sermon on the Mount, we have all sorts of stories, all sorts of things. But if you think about what Jesus in his context, what he did is he had his big gigs where he would talk to the crowds and he would, he would give sayings. Those are people that, just left him pretty much straight out. Then he had the 12 that he was with all the time. And what did he do with them? He lived with them. Okay, and I'm sure that you've all pondered what would it be like, to be part of Jesus' entourage. It would just be an amazing thing to find out what does Jesus' daily life look like. And this is kind of what mentoring is about. It's one thing for me to pontificate about what you should do in your personal life and la-di-da, but to stand behind Jesus in a Starbucks and find out. Does Jesus buy at Starbucks? Does he go for the full latte? This is where the nitty gritty happens. Where the gospel then takes feet. They saw that day in and day out. Not the Starbucks part, because I don't think they have Starbucks kind of thing. A little early. But so what he is, he invested his life in these 12. And then James, Peter, John are the kind of the inner circle. And what you find a lot in the Gospels is that, for instance, he'll say a parable, and one of those three will come and say, "What did that mean exactly?" And then he'll explain it to them. There's this kind of closeness to them. Now, I think this is a good model for ministry. Okay, what we normally think of, no matter how big your church is, you've got your big gig, right? You've got your Sunday morning service. This is where it all happens. This is where you are in the public. If you're, the worship leader, this is where, people are going to see that you do well or you do poorly. They might get a sense of the kinds of decisions, kind of theology that is behind the things that you do. But generally, it's the gig. And I think we should do that well. I think we need to take it seriously. I think that the decisions we make about worship are very important. I don't diminish that at all. And, much of what we get of in the Bible from Jesus was from these big gigs, where he's talking to the crowds. Okay, so those things are important. But it's also very clear from Jesus' ministry, and I think from our ministry, that the crowds are very fickle. I have been amazed in churches at how quickly kind of things can go sour in a church where you kind of think you're well loved, and then you find out, we really are heading in different directions, and you find out that you don't have those kinds of hooks into the crowd that you thought that you did, and even if people really love you, you do a good job and all that kind of stuff, that it's still a quite tenuous relationship, and any of you, who have been in places where you like this church that I was in for 2 years, it just was not a good fit, and nothing that I could do could kind of change the tide of the larger crowd. There are just kind of forces that are going on in the mob and crowd that there's nothing that you can. No kind of power that you have to change those kinds of things. Then you have your inner circle, your 12, and I see this in the music side of things as my choir, my praise team, the people that I work with on a smaller basis. And this is a crowd that I take very seriously. Say if I'm in choir rehearsal and I've chosen particular anthem. I want to tell them at some point why I've chosen that anthem. You know, I use this as a way of not just education, but kind of imparting vision. And part of the reason that I do this is it's because I know that all these people have spouses and kids and parents. And, you know, so if you've got 20 people in your choir in a 300-person church, you have access indirectly to 3/4 of the church just through those 20 people, you know. And so this is a place to impart vision, just generally speaking, you know, to kind of change tides, to give this sense of this is the direction, this is why we do this kind of thing. You don't have to just break it down, you know, okay, now I'm going to teach you about why we do this, and here's the theology of this and that kind of thing. But to treat them as your team, you know, as Jesus treated his disciples. He gave them assignments that were meaningful. He asked them how they went. He taught them. He told them things that he didn't tell the crowds. He explained things to them, knowing that eventually the church was going to be on their backs. And this stuff was going to all add up into something more than just a series of teachings. So to spend the time with them and impart that vision, I think is very important. And then your inner circle, and this would be the people that you mentioned, the three in Jesus' case. The people that you know, you just have a special affection for, a special closeness to, that you see specific gifts in, that you want to call out, and that's the inner circle, the mentorees that you can work with. Does this make sense to kind of as a ministry model? Yeah. Well, then go do it, for goodness sake. Be on the lookout for mentorees. Yeah, so, you know, who are those three people? I mean, it doesn't have to be three, but who is that inner circle that you intentionally invest in? Let me just make sure I'm not getting myself here. Yes. I don't have any rules for this at all. Usually what I do is I see some kind of spark of competency or interest in somebody, and then I start to invest in them. First, I'll give you an example that just to kind of encourage you that it's, because it's awkward, it's like asking somebody on a date, you know,
you want to be my mentor?
So, for instance, there was a guy in one of my classes at Northwestern who was incredibly shy. You know, he just did not say a peep. But I could tell from his writing assignments that he was very intelligent, very good communication skills on paper, was thinking about a lot of things. He was from Colorado, kind of, I guess we didn't call it Bible Belt exactly, but he was an artist, and one of these churches that has, like, you know, the big white piano and the pinkish rug, you know what I mean? It's just like everything went against the sensibilities, but that's all he knew. And so, like, there was this kind of dissonance in his faith, because what he really liked in life in terms of art and aesthetics and thinking and all these kinds of things like that, he didn't find in his church. And how do I put these things together? And I'm sure we've all been in those kinds of places with our faith. And when I would talk he was not a music major or anything. When he would talk about when I would talk about the history of the church, liturgy, and those kinds of, you could just see his eyes and he'd be like, there's a different way to worship? Oh my goodness, you know, it doesn't have to be on an overhead? And in fact, now, well, I'll tell you, I won't tell you the end yet, because it's, you need to wait for that. So I was kind of praying about, you know, I just kind of thought, you know, I would like to mentor this guy. I think he just, you know, it would be a really good fit. You know, I'm into the arts and babies, you know, I can help with sports and this stuff. And it was really funny, because I was like, hey, it's a little bit weird just to, you know, approach guys in your class and say, you want to get it for coffee, you know? And so then it was great, because a while later, he approached me and said, do you want to get together for coffee? I'm like, yes, I would. So I was in the position of Dwight then, of being like, yes, I've been waiting for this call. And what ended up happening in the end is he's actually in a seminary now, as he wants to go into more of the academic side of things, but in Episcopal Seminary, I mean, you know, it's a very different world for him. He still has faith But it's a very different kind of faith. And it's not just me, but it's the kind of people that have spoken into his life and kind of told him about things that are out there and things that are available. But always being on the lookout. It might be that you have a high school kid that shows a knack for writing songs, and you can show them a couple of chords, and you know, or someone who's a novice organist that you say, well, would you like to play an evening service sometime? You know, I'll help you go through it. I'll help you practice for that. You know, people that would never have ventured that kind of thing on their own, but you kind of call out the gift in them. You know, you say, I see something. I mean, you know, you don't have to be weird about it. You don't have to be like, I see something special in you. yeah, that's right. I'm waiting for something. Yes, it is you. So you don't have to be weird about it, but just to say, hey, you know, you're really good at that. You know, have you ever thought about, you know, playing with the praise team, you know? And so that's, you know, just kind of keep your eye out for people who could do that well. Let's see. Yes, that's right. You think you have to have a curriculum, but you don't. This next point, you don't have to show them the way to do it, you just have to show them one way. This is what mentoring is all about, is you just essentially open up your life so that they can see what you do. I mean, it's really as simple as that. It's not rocket science. You know, you don't have to be like this really, really good Christian. You don't have to, you know, have it all together, have a seminary degree, anything like that. You just basically, you just unashamedly say, this is how I do it. You know, and I'm big on this, and this is my educational philosophy as well. I studied composition, undergraduate, master's, and my undergraduate degree was great because my composition teacher would just tell me that I had to do stuff. You know, he'd say, you are now going to write a 12-tone piece that is 14 meters long. Okay, and then I would write, you know, and even if I hated it, it was the assignment. That's what you did. And in fact, we would lock horns every once in a while on kind of my, you know, semester end project. I would say this, you know, here it is. He said, that's not going to work. And I would say, no, it's going to work. I'm sure. I can hear it in my head. It's going to work. It's not going to work. And he would say, okay, change it now. And at the end of the semester, once the grade is done, then you can change it back. and you know, it was very much my way or the highway. And I learned a ton from him. When I got into the master's program, all my teachers were saying, find your voice. Like, that's kind of why I'm here. You know, like, I don't know how to do this. Can you help me out? You just need to find your voice. Oh, well, great. Thanks. You know? And so I'm very much into teachers and mentors just saying, this is how I do it. You know, when I have an intern, I have some interns from Calvin sometimes, and I have an initial meeting with them, and I kind of let them know up front what they're getting into. I find out what they can do and what I, you know, just tell them, this is what I think I can give you. I'm in a kind of a peculiar kind of church, so if they want praise team, for instance, they're not going to, you know, get that as part of their internship. And I say, I'm just going to teach you how I do it. You know, I'm going to, and there's a good method of it where I do and you watch, you do and I watch you do, I think is how the phrase goes. But, you know, this just slowly handing over the reins to them. And so what I'll do is I'll just say, you probably have not thought a lot about filing choir music, you know, and it's not something that many people think about much at all. But if you are going to be a choir director, you're going to have a filing system. Here's my filing system, and I show them, and they have a way to file things. Now, they can probably come up with a lot better way, but I would very much rather give them something to rebel from. You know, I would rather, and I tell them this up front, look, I don't care if you espouse this philosophy of filing choir octavos. It doesn't bother me at all, right? But when you work for me, you're going to do it this way, you know, and you're going to learn a system, and then you use whatever system that you want to. And probably what will happen, they've got a couple choices. They'll use your exact system, they'll throw away your system and do what they want, or they'll have some kind of hybrid that fits them even better. And that's great. That's exactly as it should be. But it's a whole lot better than them not having any system at all, and they get on the job and they have just piles and piles of octavos with no sense of what to do with them. At least they know how I do it. Now, that's a very mundane thing, but there are, you know, so well, what do I do when I choose hymns? And so I say, first thing we're going to do is you're going to watch me do this. And I say, first thing I do, I throw the net wide, and I get 12 songs when I need to. And then, and then I narrow it down, and I do this. And then I say, now next time, you're going to do it. So come back next week with 12 songs, and here's how I want it. I'm real particular about keys. So I say, you're going to get 12 songs on this theme to fit this slot, and here's what's happening. It's got to come from this, go into this. I want 12 songs that could fit, and I want you to label them key, slash, name, and then where you got it. And if it's something that I'm not going to know, then bring it in. You know, and that's the rule. They bring it in, we go through it, we talk about it, and then we can talk about why I would not use that one in this situation, but why this one would work. You know, now we've narrowed it down to 3, all right? Now for next week, you choose the exact one and, you know, and prepare it for a folder. See, you know, that's just a very methodical way of saying, this is how I do it, and now you have a way to do it. It's, you know, a way to do it. So just whatever your area is, just show that person what it is, whether it's Bible study, sermon preparation, whatever it is. Just say, this is how I do it, and if you want to mentor with me, that's what we're going to do. I'm not going to teach you a bunch of things that a book can tell you you can do. I'm going to teach you how I do it. It doesn't need to be another class. Same kind of thing. You know, you don't need to have a curriculum. Don't underestimate the power of imparting vision through back door. We talked about this a little bit in terms of the crowd, you know, how the crowd turned on Jesus. You really have relatively little sway over a large group of people. I mean, that's just the reality. The one thing that you can do, though, is you can impart vision through the back door. So instead of directing, you know, for me, you know, my pastor the other day, about a year ago, a lot of days other ago, you know, said, you know what I think we could do? We could have a congregational meeting on worship. And I said, yeah, great idea. Why don't you just have a full formal trial, you know, where anybody can bring their grievances. Like, the last thing in the world that I want is this open discussion on worship, because it's never going to go well for me, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, 200 against 1, you know. And I would be right. That's the thing. No. But you just, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you've worked in churches, it's just a no-win situation, right? It doesn't matter how many degrees you have, it doesn't matter how long you've done it, it's just one opinion among many when you get into the crowd. You know, everybody starts talking about, I like this and I like that, and you just don't make any headway with, well, I don't care if you like it, what does God like? You know, yeah, that's really going to get you a lot of points with the crowd. But what does happen... Let's say you go to your choir and you say, let's say I went to my choir, which I did, and I said, we're not doing a lectionary song. The reason we're doing a lectionary song is because, in my opinion, a Reformed church that doesn't sing a psalm in every service, that's just a travesty. There's just no excuse for that. There's no, I think, no excuse for any Christian church to go through a week without singing a psalm. I just don't think it's right. And especially for a Reformed tradition that has such a rich tradition of psalmody, we're going to do a psalm every week. The best vehicle that we have to help us avoid doing Psalm 23 for 30 weeks out of the year is a lectionary psalm. So we're doing a lectionary psalm. Now, and you know, and I kind of explained to them, this is where we're going. And now some of this is going to be difficult. All right, it's going to be harder than choosing hymns. It's going to be sometimes emotionally distant from where you are, archaic, all sorts of things. But we're going to commit to this because it's a spiritual discipline. And then I talked to them about responsive psalmody, which is normally a Catholic thing, which a lot of Reformed people get really, you know, kind of freaked out about. You know, this sounds a little bit Catholic, right? And so that's bad, or what do you think? So then, when we go into the church and we do what is essentially a Catholic form of psalmody, I know that these people in the choir have talked to their people. They're ready, you know, when at dinner time that day, when they're going to have roast music minister, someone from the choir is going to say, well, actually, don't you think every Reformed church should be doing a psalm every week? You know, and so suddenly you've got this, you know, person who's an apologetic for your way of thinking. And I've found that this is a more effective way of influencing the crowd than it is trying to just approach it head on and say, let's all vote about responsive songs, you know? And then experience before knowledge. All of you postmoderns will agree with this automatically, but I think that all of you moderns need to think about this too. The tradition that I come from, the Reformed tradition, tends to be quite cerebral, tends to be very doctrinal in its approach. You kind of hammer out the doctrines and then let life follow. I would submit to you that experience always comes before belief, in the sense that you just don't out of nowhere decide to believe in Jesus. There's something that's going on in your heart, in your life, that causes you to think about that. And so I would say don't be ashamed of letting experience lead. You know, don't feel like, okay, if you're going to work with me, you need to believe these, you know, 4 points. You know, you need to believe two of them. You need to, whatever it is that you know, would like to impart, you're going to make a lot more headway on, you know, something like predestination or whatever by living it, letting it come up in conversation. You know, here's what I've thought about these kinds of things, or let the person ask the question. So experience before knowledge. Let them experience something, and they will automatically ask the questions and start to figure out the doctrinal parts of things. The fruit of mentoring. Well, I'll just say this, because I do want to take a couple questions. I'll just say it's. I'm not an expert at this, but it's been a very rich experience for me. A couple weekends ago, I went to the wedding of one of my former students, you know, a very close student. And you know what's the coolest thing in the whole world? If you want to, like, feel really good about yourself and that you're not wasting your life, I've had a couple times where I'll be at some kind of denominational meeting or something like that, and someone will introduce themselves. They'll go, "Oh, you're Greg Shear." And I'll think, you know, that they're going to say, "The author of The Art of Worship." I'm like, "Yeah." And then they go, "You know, your former student works at my church." You know, one time the guy said, "You think there are 4 members of the Trinity the way he talks about you." but I think I'm not to say something braggy about me, but just that you just, I'm not thinking that when I'm interacting with somebody, you know, who is eager to learn. I'm just thinking, wow, here's someone that's, you know, going into my vocation and I want to teach them something, you know. And then what ends up happening is that it's really pivotal, you know, that they're thinking about the kinds of things that I'm thinking about. And then you find out, you know, 5 years down the road, that they're actually in the church doing a really, really good job of applying the things that you taught them in their own situation. And then what's really funny is that some of them, they end up in churches that I would just hate, you know, and they do a great job at it, you know. Like, wow, that's really cool that they're living out all the stuff that we talked about. They're making decisions for themselves that, you know, it wouldn't be my style, but they're applying it in their own situation, which I think is totally cool. So, if you want to feel good about yourself, you know, that's the other reason to do this, but that's a real selfish reason. We have 6 minutes. Is that right? 6 minutes worth of questions. Yeah?
My theory of other younger people here is that a lot of us were teens when the worship changes started to happen, with the modern worship coming in. And what the result of that is now we're in our 20s and we've got a lot of band members who are in their 60s or in their 50s. What would you say about mentoring musicians who are older than you?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I have
that
same question.
I'll tell you just a slight variation on that. Every time I've mentored, it's always been someone younger or someone I would say that is kind of lower me than me on the ladder, right? And what is kind of goofy about my particular church right now is that we have a number of people that are older and who have been doing exactly what I'm doing for a number of years. And it's a very interesting situation because most churches I've gone into very eager to mentor. And in this particular church, that wouldn't work, or that wouldn't be appreciated at all. I think if you had the right person, it is possible. But it would... Might just, you know, off the bat, like I said, I'm not an expert. I won't give you any statistics about this, but I think it'd be fairly hard to do it on both a musical and an emotional level. because there's a distance there. You're actually learning from them. Now, maybe it could be a two-way mentoring. You mentor them musically, they mentor you spiritually. I think that's great. But it does, when someone is kind of over you in age or authority, it does change that relationship quite a bit.
Twist on that, a slight one. I had a choir member who's very gifted in writing words and is a good teacher. Came to me and said, "I want your help specifically in these areas." And I was almost hesitant to do that because I'm 50, he's 63, you know. But I figured the church had come out the winter, so it's kind of been, like you said, it's been a partnership. But I was very hesitant at first because of the age thing.
You know, with that, I mean, mentoring is maybe not even the best word. Basically, what, you know, two things. One is it's very different. 20 to even 30 is a very different thing than 40 to 50. You know, there are different kind of grades there. At a certain point, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure a 15 to 70 year old would disagree with this, but you know, you've been through some kind of major milestones together. You know, so there's not quite as much distance there. I would say let's change the word for mentoring to simply helping someone explore the gifts. In that particular case, the church is the winner. You know, if you can help someone go from being a mediocre songwriter to being a really great songwriter that is giving a really, you know, important gift to the church, you know, I mean, that's win-win. So you don't need to think about it like that kind of hierarchical, now I will mentor you kind of thing, but just simply, let me help you with that thing. Other questions?
What would you suggest if you don't have a... I'm a music teacher, but I'm not a music... I don't have any position in the church. So all these things go on. I have ideas for what could happen, but I don't have any say necessarily.
Yes. And I would say that what you're bringing up, I mean, as I'm reading the subtext, is that there's some things that you think... they could really speak into, and they wouldn't drive you quite as crazy if you did. And I think that it depends on the person. Now, if you have a humble minister of worship that has kind of a teachable spirit, it could be that you could say, "Look, I know a whole lot about music. I could teach you how to do modulation. I could teach you how to do transitions. I could do, you know, a bunch of stuff like that that might be really, really good for your ministry. Would you like to do some of that?" You know, or maybe even I'd like to learn more about worship, or you know, something to that effect. You're not going to make much headway by saying, you know, "You're really not so good, and I would like to make you a little bit less not so good." You know, that wouldn't be the. So if you can find a way in, I would say, yeah, definitely. You don't have. It doesn't have to be anything official at all. One more question, and then I've answered all questions.
So what you're talking about in this case, or maybe something else, is not so much a mentoring like the older people in my life, like my grandfather or people like that, but more like a mutual exchange of ideas.
Yeah. There's kind of more of a sideway, I don't know if you'd call it accountability or you know, walking the faith together, whatever. So for instance, one thing that I'm thinking about, I'm a composer. And I keep meeting people about my age whose work I really admire. And I was thinking, you know what would be great is to get about an email list of about 5 people and just say, let's take this, use this email list to exchange songs and just kind of iron sharpen iron, you know. And I think that is completely legitimate. I mean, I just think that if people are not humble enough to take the honest assessment of a brother or sister in Christ, then there's a problem, you know. And we need to be willing to do that too. That's the other part of this, is that we need to, you know, always be looking to how can I be better at what God has called me to do? How can I be a better Christian? I mean, I know that sounds kind of you know, weird to say I want to be a better Christian, a better person, but I think that's legitimate for us to think about, you know. And how does someone else call out those gifts in me, even if they're an equal to me? We work on partners. So, you know, partnership instead of mentoring in that particular thing. Thank you all very much. So much fun to have a packed house.